Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place and space. I'm Dave Schloem. One of the nice things about living in rural California next to the Sacramento River is that I regularly get to see bald eagles soaring overhead. It's always a thrill to see these majestic birds, which are so easily distinguished from the turkey vultures they tend to share thermal currents with due to their larger size and, of course, the striking white plumage on their heads. So I decided it would be interesting to learn more about these birds from some folks who know them well. Later on in the show, we'll talk to Terry Lewillier from Redding, California, and David Hancock from British Columbia about eagle cams, cameras set up near eagle nests to watch their nesting behavior. Watching eagles rearing their young is a real treat and something of a phenomenon on YouTube with cameras throughout the United States. But first, let's get some Eagles 101 with our guide, Michelle Hawkins, director of the California Raptor Center at UC Davis. She joins us now. Michelle Hawkins, welcome back to Blue Dot.
Hi, thanks for having me back, Dave.
Well, the last time we talked to you, we talked about vultures. And what got me interested in vultures was watching eagles and seeing them with vultures. So now I want to find out about the eagles because they really thrill me. So we want you to give us an Eagles 101. Is that okay?
Sure, I'll do my best.
Perfect. Well, all right, let's talk about classification. What exactly are eagles?
So they are considered a raptor, as many other birds are. And so raptor was the Latin word for to eat viciously. And so that really sums it up pretty well, I think. But eagles, falcons, kites, and hawks are all in the same taxonomic group of raptors. The accipitriformes, say that three times really quickly. And here in the United States, we have two of our own species of eagles.
Can you talk about the distribution and types of eagles we find around the planet? There are a lot of different kind of eagles, aren't there?
Oh my gosh, yes. I can't give you a number off the top of my head as to how many different species of eagles there are, but there are a lot. You know, the stellar sea eagles that are just massive and beautiful, to the harpy eagle in Brazil and in other parts of South America that eat monkeys. You know, I mean, these are humongous birds of prey. And so, and everything in between that, with our bald eagle, sadly, being one of the world's smallest eagles.
Wow. Okay. Well, let's focus on our eagles, the eagles we find in the United States. And we have the golden eagle and the bald eagle. Is that the only eagles we find here?
Yes, those are the only two eagles we have in the United States.
And can you tell us a bit about the differences between, let's start with golden eagles. Tell us about them.
It was really interesting. I had not seen a golden eagle until I came out to California, being from the East Coast. So golden eagles are really found predominantly in the western part of the U.S., and they live in areas that just about any other raptor lives in, with the exception of our very, very urban areas. But, you know, here in and around Sacramento area, for example, I see golden eagles when I go out, you know, just barely into the country. So we have a lot of them here. They predominantly live in the valley areas, and they're not near bodies of water. And that's part of their feeding strategies as well. Bald eagles are fish-eating eagles only. That's all they eat. And in captivity, sometimes we can get them to eat some rodents, but they are fish-eating eagles, whereas the golden eagle eat predominantly mammals and carrion, already dead things. It will definitely eat that as well.
Yeah, I've seen golden eagles in the Black Butte Reservoir area around Orland, California, and they're just magnificent birds. They're big.
They are. They're actually very equivalent in size to the bald eagle. The males of both and the females of both really are about the same body weight. And if you remember, in the raptor world, girls rule. So the females are the bigger of the species, and to some degree by a substantial amount. So people will see two eagles on a nest cam, for example, and automatically think that the larger of the two is going to be the male, and it's the reverse of that. Mm-hmm.
And you talked a little bit about the type of prey, but what would typically be the diet of a golden eagle here in California?
Lots of gophers. You know, that type of size of mammal is pretty much what they will go for when they're hunting on their own. Ground squirrels, but gophers are a big part of their diet. But they will eat, you know, what's there to eat. So going out for a vole or, you know, a mouse or something is, you know, that's like eating one potato chip, right? You can't just eat one. So it's, you know, that's just not enough food for them. So they're going to need something larger than that. But usually I think gopher is about the standard size. They will take rabbits, jackrabbits, that look like they're bigger than they really are. And in fact, they really only weigh a couple of pounds, probably. So not, you know, any of the animals that they take, even if they look like they're kind of big, they really aren't that heavy.
Yeah. And let's talk about them from a conservation status, because back when I was a kid, there was, you know, tremendous concern about, you know, our national symbol is the bald eagle. Mm-hmm. And they are magnificent, beautiful birds. And, you know, they were having difficulties due to DDT, you know, pesticide mm-hmm. use, you know, moving it, since they're at the top of their food chain, all of that nasty stuff was accumulating in them and, you know, thinning right. their eggs and things like that. To talk about them, because they're kind of a conservation success story.
They are absolutely a success story. It is very hard to, I have to admit, to jump for joy when an animal comes off the endangered species list, because when they're on the endangered species list, they have so many protections. And, you know, they go on there for a very good reason when their numbers have plummeted, as they did back in the DDT days in the 70s. And it took until, I think it was less than 10 years ago, that they just got delisted. And so it's, you know, we all root for them. We want to see their numbers come back up. But it also takes away some of those protections that they were afforded as well. Now being our, you know, the American emblem, the American eagle is the national bird, you know, probably get a little bit more recognition than maybe other not so well-known birds that might be on the endangered species list. But yeah, it took a lot of effort by a lot of people to be able to get these birds back to numbers where they are self-sustaining now all throughout the United States. And it's great to see, absolutely great to see.
Yeah, as I recall, Benjamin Franklin wanted the turkey to be our national emblem bird.
he did.
But I'm glad they decided on eagles.
I'm kind of glad somebody talked him out of that. No offense, yeah, turkeys.
Because they are just magnificent. And they're so fun to watch when they're flying. And we'll talk about that more in a bit. What are some of the problems that still face eagles?
Lead intoxication, sadly. We talked about it when we were talking about vultures not that long ago, and here we are, we're going to be talking about it again today, because for both bald eagles and golden eagles had really significant issues with lead intoxication, and still do. The golden eagle particularly does. So with the bald eagle in the early 1980s, because waterfowl were hunted then with lead ammunition, it was thought that bald eagles were getting lead intoxication as well, because there would be shell pieces, you know, they're nice and shiny, and of course fish would eat them, and then the eagle would eat the fish. And it doesn't take very much lead at all to intoxicate one of these magnificent birds. So I believe it was in 1982, we banned the use of lead ammunition for hunting waterfowl. And that really helped tremendously for getting the numbers up for the bald eagles from that end of things. And that really, to this day, it's nowhere near as dramatic a plight as it is for the golden eagle that still eats, as I said, a lot of carrion. So they'll be eating, you know, side by side with the California condor, with the turkey vultures. And when a lead ammunition hits a carcass, it just splits into a million pieces and it goes throughout the entire carcass. So, you know, even though the animal may have been shot, say in the head, you know, you could still have lead down through the front legs and even into some of that muscle tissue, like over the chest, you know, and even going on back from there a little bit. So it's dramatic when you see an X-ray of an animal that has been shot with lead, to see just how incredibly it splits up. So every bite could be deadly depending upon the animal and where they are at the time that they get it. You know, if they're not found in the right amount of time, they will die from their lead intoxication.
Yeah, and I'm a fly angler for trout here in Northern California. It's one of the reasons I refuse to use any kind of lead split shot. I will always go with something that's, you know, more benign, like tin. It may not sink as well, but I want to try to do all I can to protect those beautiful birds.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, we have had to make lead sinkers illegal as well, because people still wanted to use them for the very reason you just mentioned. And, it, you know, until you see it and you really know what it does and how it could affect them. So, you know, with just these one little bite, it's hard for people to understand just how traumatic this is. But it really is. You know, it's not being overstated at all. But we did get a leg up, so to speak, on that. At the same time, though, that was when the population was crashing tremendously anyway because of DDT. And so with this, you know, with this success of not seeing as much lead intoxication in swans, for example, who will eat, you know, shiny bits as well. And we used to see a lot of lead intoxication in those birds from picking it up out of waterways. We don't see anywhere near as much of that as we used to see.
Well, let's focus on bald eagles a bit, because they're quite ubiquitous in my area. And just, I think, one of the most beautiful birds I've ever seen. Whenever I go outside, and I see them about, I would say on average, about once every 10 days. And I'll be looking up at the sky and watching the turkey vultures soaring overhead. And then I'll instantly know, it's like, oh, that's not a turkey vulture. That's a bald eagle. And then you'll see the sunlight hit that glint of white off the head. And it's just, it's such a thrill. They're such magnificent flying machines. Can you talk a bit about their ability to fly, say, compared to a turkey vulture?
Sure. I mean, I think both of them have the ability to soar on a thermal, for example. So a thermal meaning, you know, you get kind of funnels of heat in the atmosphere. And when birds can get those, it can help them to stay aloft without them having to exert themselves by flapping to fly, you know? And so they can definitely soar, but they don't soar at all like the turkey vulture does. And because they're eating fish, you know, they have to be able to see off the reflection of waters. So their visual acuity has to be really incredible. And, you know, they know right when to hit that water to be able to get that fish. It always stuns me when you see one coming in for the proverbial landing and you don't see anything at all. And boy, their legs go in and they come up and they're, you know, they're surfing some amazing fish coming out of the water. So, they can swoop so quickly, not like a peregrine falcon by any chance, but, you know, if you look at an osprey and you look at a bald eagle as they go to fish, they're both very dramatic. But with the bald eagle, because the foot is so large and the power in those feet is so intense, you know, they just plunge their legs all the way in and grab on to that fish as they're coming up, trying to keep the upper part of their body dry because it makes it a lot easier for them to be able to get out of the water if they're not, you know, sodden and water soaked as well. So they try, you know, if and I'm sure you've seen them do it, or at least in videos, if nothing else.
Well, I've seen them do it live right in front of me. Yeah.
Yes, I know. I'm very envious of the number that you must see up in your area, because being around Lake Shasta And, you know, and now that it has water in it, I can imagine that you're seeing a lot more of them around there again.
Oh, yeah.
But it is. It's very dramatic when you see them fish. They're very, very powerful.
Yeah, I see them on the river all the time. In fact, they're kind of funny that I know some fishing guides in the area. And a lot of times they identify like, oh, yeah, I know that fishing guide. And sometimes the guides will like catch a trout and toss it out for them. And they'll go get it. It's like they've kind of, okay, yeah, thanks.
Yes, they're incredibly bright animals. And, you know, nobody will turn down a handout, you know, at times. If you can save a little energy, why not? If somebody's going to give you that trout that you're going to have to expend that energy for, why not?
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we return, we'll continue our look at the lives of eagles with our guest, director of the California Raptor Center at UC Davis, Michelle Hawkins. I'm Dave Shlohm, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. Our guest is Dr. Michelle Hawkins, director of the California Raptor Center at UC Davis, and we're talking about the lives of what many consider the most magnificent of raptor species, eagles. They have really big nests. Can you talk a bit about their nests and how they build them and where they like them?
Yeah, they like them up in the tops of very tall trees. You know, we have oaks here that are out near the Sacramento River, for example. You know, they're a couple hundred feet up and they'll be right up in the top of those. Because they're nesting at this time of year and their chicks are, they only stay in the nest, or they only stay with the parents, I should say, just for a few weeks after they have fledged and that they can fly on their own. You know, and then they disperse away from the parents, like, and that's very similar with just about every hawk, et cetera, you know, with the exception of the golden eagle that stays with the parents for sometimes up to 2 years.
Wow.
To learn how to hunt. Yeah.
Is that because the hunting is just much more difficult, or why do you think that is?
Yeah, it is. It's during drought, there's going to be very low times of being able to get food, and they may have to change strategy a little bit and choose food that they wouldn't have chosen otherwise. They have more ability, granted, I mean, the bald eagle can fish for a salmon or it can fish for a trout or, you know, depending upon which waterway and where it is. But nonetheless, it's still a fish coming out of a waterway. And, you know, but for the goldens, they may have to be cruising for quite a while looking to try to find something rummaging on the ground for them to be able to eat. And so they have to expend a lot more energy looking for that. And from the height that they're flying as well, because they fly at, I can't remember how many feet it is. I used to know this, so that they're looking down at the ground as they're going. It takes a lot of precision. So if a bald eagle chick, for example, we just had one in a nest here in Sacramento that was big rage while I was away last week, that there was damage to the nest. And the nest just couldn't accommodate three chicks anymore, that they removed one chick from the nest and has placed it now with a captive animal to hopefully be able to rear it like we rear with surrogates, with hawks and eagles and owls as well. And, you know, hopefully then once that animal learns from this other adult eagle, it'll be able to be released fairly quickly after it's learned to fly, and it'll be able to get out there on its own.
What kind of success rate do they have with chicks? I'm curious. It's like for, say, an eagle's nest, we have one in Redding with two chicks right now. What are the chances of those two chicks surviving to adulthood?
Because, you know, eagles are at the very high end of the food chain here, so to speak, and the raptors, most of their offspring will go on to be successfully fledged. And yeah, so most of the time they will. Now, they often, you know, will have them a couple of days apart. And so there may be a, for example, we had a nest not that many years ago now that had five in it. Well, it just can't, they can't support five chicks. So a couple of those chicks are probably not going to make it. But usually with, say, three chicks to a nest, two to three chicks is standard what they have. And they can successfully raise all of those compared with many of the other raptors that often are doing great if they've got 60 to 80% success rate.
Interesting. It also fascinates me watching the eagle cams, especially the one in Redding here near where I live. They're such attentive parents. Can you talk about the parenting skills of bald eagles?
Yeah. And, you know, I think, you know, the eagles get a lot of kudos for this when, in fact, all raptors do this. They generally, in the first few weeks of life, the chicks are still don't have a lot of plumage on them. They're just, you know, just a bit of fluff. And so that could either make it be too cold, depending upon where they are, or too hot, you know, one of the two. And so one of the parents stays and protects the chick, be it, and usually in those first few weeks, it's the female, and the male goes out and hunts so that she can sit on the chick, so to speak, and keep them temperature regulated for whatever that temperature is going to be. And then as they get to get some feathering on them and they start to stand up and are stretching their wings and are, you know, starting to move into that second phase of getting ready to be able to fledge, they don't have to be covered and coddled quite as much. And then the female may go out and start hunting, or both of them will go out and start hunting, you know, when the chicks are turnkey and can be, you know, left at home alone for a little while.
They get to be latchkey chicks.
Yeah, latchkey chicks.
Interesting. It's just amazing to me to watch them go catch a rainbow trout, for example, in the Sacramento River, and bring it back to the nest. And as you said, the term raptor means fierce eaters. And they just, you know, they rip into this fish so fiercely. And yet when they're feeding the youngs, they're just so gentle about it. It's just fascinating to watch.
Yeah. And, you know, they rip the bits off, trying to make sure that they don't give the chick a piece of cartilage that's going to catch in its throat when they're really, you know, when they're really small, things like that. So they are, you know, not unlike, you know, we as parents cut up our children's food for them. That's exactly what they're doing as well.
Oh, that's fascinating. And what about their mating habits? Do they mate for life, or how does that work?
They come back together. It's believed they definitely come back together as mating pairs virtually every year. The pair doesn't always stay together outside of the nesting period, but they generally come back together again. Now, having said that, if a parent is deceased for whatever reason, they will take another mate.
Yeah, we've observed that with our eagle up here. She's had a few mates over the years. And how long do eagles live?
Well, in the wild, I mean, it just depends upon how harsh their environment is. Obviously, you know, with all of the factors that go along with, you know, the drought, or, you know, I mean, Lake Shasta wasn't there that many years ago, right? You know, so those animals had to go somewhere else and try to find food that they might have been moving into a territory of another eagle. And they are territorial as well. So, you know, they can't just pick up and decide that the pickings are going to be better, you know, around the fork, because that could be some other eagle's territory there. So they're going to try to stay in their own territory, and they like to build. And you've seen these nests. I mean, they're incredible how big they are, or they look like they're so big until you start saying you can't get more than three chicks in it. But the adults also have to come and be able to roost on the cup of the nest. you know, one needs to be able to get into the nest to be able to help to feed, cut up the food for the chicks and be able to feed in there. So there has to be good room and good space for everybody, but it still needs to be within their own territory. And they, it's not that they can't move into a new territory, but there's sometimes some pretty epic battles over a territory if somebody else is already there.
But say they're in a territory and doing well, thriving there, how long do they live?
We say maybe about half the time that they live in captivity, and there are eagles that live to be 50 in captivity. So
50 years old.
Some people have seen and can tell that they see the same balds coming back year after year after year, you know, to the nest. And if they're banded, then you certainly can get a good idea of how old those animals are.
Then after they've, you know, fledged their young and then and they've, you know, left the nest, do they go elsewhere? I would imagine, especially in a climate like Northern California, where it gets very hot in the summer, do they move to, you know, cooler places for the summer?
No, because they have a territory, and that is that's their home. You know, so if they leave it completely, somebody else may move in and take over their nest. So it's important to keep that home territory protected. So they may disperse within that territory. And to you and I, territory, you know, maybe 20 miles or more, you know, so you might not see them again until next year, or necessarily know that you're seeing the same one that you saw the year before. But they're generally in their territory, in that territory that they has been designated for that particular nesting couple. And, you know, in some place like Lake Shasta, I mean, you're going to have many, many different pairs, I would think, nesting out there.
Well, it's interesting to think about, you know, when they do get off the nest, that they're still around then. They're still in the area. They're just not on that nest all the time.
That's right. Yeah, mm-hmm. That's right.
Let's talk about some of their, you know, fascinating anatomical parts, because they have just amazing. Let's start with the beaks. Their beaks are really something.
Yes, they are. And, you know, again, a bigger raptor, the beak is magnificent, you know, but if you look at an owl or if you look at a hawk, they still have that same tearing capability. It's just on a little bit smaller scale than our eagles. So it looks so much more daunting when you see it. But when you're up close to it, it is very, you know, you got to have a lot of respect for it. They can do some serious damage to you from both ends of the bird. Bald eagles, the business end of these birds is their feet, but their beaks are substantial as well. And they can do some serious ripping of things. A very good, very long-term volunteer of ours from the California Raptor Center was holding a wild eagle one day, and she let her guard down a little bit. And the bird had a hood on. When you put a hood over their heads, it calms them. And so we do that when we have to handle them. And she, while it had its hood on, she had it and was holding it sitting down on a chair, and she had it kind of between her arms, and she loosened up just enough that bird was able to put its head up, and it just grabbed upward and it grabbed her upper lip and it just split it right open in a second. So, I mean, it was literally a second, you know, so it's unbelievable what they can do with that. And they can do it very, very quickly.
Well, you mentioned that unfortunate incident, but tell us a bit about your work at the California Raptor Center. And I imagine that, you know, safety training's got to be something that's very important to you.
Yeah, very much so. Especially when we're working with bald eagles, we'll wear face shields so that we can protect ourselves in the event that that bird does get loose and could get at us. But predominantly when you're working with the eagles, A, you have to have pretty good upper body strength in order to be able to hold that animal if it decides it's going to struggle, and they will, even when they're hooded.
How much does a typical bald eagle weigh?
Yeah, so a male bald eagle, generally around 8 pounds. A female can be up to 15. And so it doesn't sound like a ton.
But it's all muscle.
Yeah, it is. It's pure muscle. And, you know, they start to grip and move, and you're going to have your work cut out for you. So obviously day one volunteers don't get to handle the eagles. It takes quite a bit of training and safety training in order to be able to handle them. And even then, when we have somebody new handling, you know, we're watching very carefully right there with them the whole step of the way, making sure that, you know, that there is a backup for that moment in time. If somebody makes a mistake, you're probably not going to be able to stop something. But generally what we do is we wear welder's gloves. And, you know, if you've ever seen a good pair of welder's gloves, I particularly like for the eagles to have the ones that come up above the elbow. We generally always wear long sleeved clothes. Not that that would stop an eagle if it was going to talon you, but at least some barrier, you know, between it and you otherwise. But we use welder's gloves. If once I get them in hand, and you know, I've been handling them for about 25 years now, I can remove my gloves and I'll hold one leg in each hand. And then I'll basically cup the body of the animal between my arms up against my chest. So you can appreciate how it could be close to your mouth, you know?
My. Yeah.
Yeah. So
don't try this at home.
Thank you very much. So yeah, if there's ever an eagle that anybody sees on the side of the road that's injured, don't try to do the heroics and go, oh, I've got a blanket in the back, I'll just throw that over them, it'll be fine. Yeah, they can nail you. And if you get an eagle stuck in telling you, that eagle has to decide almost when it's chosen to stop telling you in order to be able to get those talons out sometimes. They just can latch, you know, and they've got a ratchet type mechanism too, that when they can lock their talons so that as they're carrying that, you know, squiggly fish, you know, that they're locked in place. And so you don't want them locking in place on you.
Do you have maybe a favorite success story of a bald eagle or a golden eagle that you were able to rehabilitate and release back into the wild that was, you know, one that, you know, particularly sticks with you?
Yeah, there was a lead intoxication bird that was very ill when it came in, and we try to be as pragmatic as we can, because sometimes they are just too far gone when you get them that even all the heroics you could throw at them, you know, all the manpower and all the money that you could throw at them, it's probably not going to turn them around. Just that's years and years of experience, you know, of looking at the actual concentrations that they have of that in their blood. And so this golden California Department of Fish and Wildlife wasn't sure that it was going to be able to be rehabilitated. And even if it was, it's possible that there could be some brain damage that's done that could be permanent and that we may not know about, you know? So we have to be very careful about releasing those birds and making sure that we feel confident in releasing them. But this bird was one of those birds that was on the borderline. And my colleague at the time said, we shouldn't pursue this bird. But this bird just seemed to have the joie de vivre, you know, if you will, that it wanted to live. And so I had to push my colleagues a little bit. I think this one's worth pursuing. And we did. And it took a number of months, because the other thing about lead is that when the concentration gets to be really high and it's chronic, you can use what's called a chelator and remove the lead from the blood. But when it's been there chronically, they will actually start to lay down that lead into their bones. So when I remove it out of the blood, it seems to, you know, it's gone, right? It's negative. And, but then we wait a week and then we retest again to see if there was some in the bone. And of course, this bird definitely had it. So it ended up having to go through 4 rounds of chelation. And chelation is hard on the kidneys as well. So we're causing harm while we're trying to cause good. And so, you know, every day I was just stressed saying, you know, I hope I made the right decision to pursue this bird, because it's stressful for the bird. They're in captivity. That's not where they should ever be. And then this bird was with us for, I think, almost 4 months. And so before we released it, in order to make sure that it actually could target properly, California Department of Fish and Wildlife had a falconer that works with eagles fly that bird and hunt that bird to make sure it could hunt before we released it. So that gave us confidence in releasing it when time came. I just saw something and I was hoping that I wasn't reading too much into it. And this particular one really ended up going the right way for us.
Wow, what a great story. Well, Michelle Hawkins, director of the California Raptor Center at UC Davis, thanks for sharing that story and your knowledge about eagles with us. And thanks for your work at the Raptor Center for all of the raptors here in California.
Well, thank you so much, Dave. Really appreciate being on.
Thanks to our guest, Michelle Hawkins, director of the California Raptor Center at UC Davis. We're going to take a short break, but stick around. Coming up next, we'll check out the growing popularity and importance of eagle cams. I'm Dave Schlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Recently, producer Matt Fidler and I both have become enthralled watching the Friends of the Redding Eagles cam, which shows the nesting pair of bald eagles Liberty and Guardian. Liberty hatched 2 eggs successfully in March, and it's been fascinating to watch the 2 eaglets being reared by their attentive parents. Joining us to talk about eagle cams are Terry Lewillier from the Friends of the Redding Eagles and her mentor David Hancock. David is a pioneer in the use of eagle cams and is the co-founder of the Hancock Wildlife Foundation in British Columbia. They join us now. Terry and David, welcome to Blue Dot.
Well, I'm pleased to be here, and I'm also pleased to have Terry on the other line again. I've been to her place a number of times and viewed her eagles with her many times. Yeah.
Yes, yes.
Good. Yeah, Terry, just briefly, tell us a bit about David. You said he was a real mentor to you.
Oh, goodness. Yes, he is. He's been someone who's kind of showed me the ropes. I can never do as much as he does, but I'm trying to do that on a small scale here in the Northern California area, where we monitor about 23 bald eagle nests, my husband and I, along with the one we have the Redding Eagle Cam on. But David up there in BC monitors, I think, is at 400 something.
Well, yes. Just a couple of nights ago, I signed in nest number 696 in the valley here.
Wow.
Wow. So he's got just a very dense population of bald eagles. But he's my go-to person for anything about knowledge about bald eagles. He's taught me everything I know, and he's written several books about it. And he's just an unbelievably dedicated person, and we're just so lucky to have him in the eagle world.
And David, could you just tell us briefly the background for you of starting eagle cams? Because they've become very popular. What is it that about eagle cams that you think is very important for eagle conservation?
I was giving a talk in 2005, and the guy came to the lady in charge of the talk and said, "Can I have 7 minutes to show a video? I'm in a great rush and I have to run off." He showed it. He didn't even leave me his name, but I found out his name. I went to his house a week later because I was so impressed with what I saw. He had a camera connected directly to a nest above his house, down to his living room, and he recorded an eagle in labor. It went 9 times into the camera and looked down, and it had laid a bloody egg.
Oh, wow.
I mean, that was awesome. Yeah. And it was on video. I mean, I've been a beagle biologist all my life. I had my first eagle at 14. I'm now 86. And so, I mean, that was just an incredible incident. And so I went to his house, and he ended up letting us make the connection into the nest onto the web. Now, it took quite a few months because this is before streaming video was popular. And so it took a very high-tech people, and it took Microsoft. I have to admit, it took an old connection that I had with a Falconer in Microsoft, one of the executives, to make it all work. And they got us more and more servers connected. And so over the first 2 years, I mean, one of the great joys of my life, I shouldn't really say this, but one of the great joys of my life was, according to Microsoft, we had the world's largest website in the entire world. More people tuned in to watch Eagles than any other site. And the world, the site that they beat the previous numbers on was the Pope.
Oh, my.
What a, you don't get to beat the Pope many times.
Yeah. Oh, that's a stunt. That's amazing.
So I was very pleased that Eagles had beaten the Pope.
Terry, tell us about your Eagles there in Redding, California. How long have you had the Eagle Cam going there? And tell us a bit about Liberty and her mates.
Okay. Well, we got our first Eagle Cam here in Redding in 2008. And we have been going since then till now. And we've actually been with the same female. Liberty has been with us all these years. So it's been phenomenal watching her. She's had 3 mates already. And she's on her 3rd mate. And she's on numbers 27 and 28 for eaglets. And so it's been an absolute joy watching her all these years, you know, through the Eagle Cam. And I was a teacher. So as an educator, I saw immediately the value of an Eagle Cam in my classroom as an educational tool. And it's just a unique way for people to have this peek into the lives of a pair of nesting bald eagles, and watching them raising their young is just absolutely incredible.
And could you tell us a bit about ways you go about, and David, you can answer this if you wish, ways you go about protecting the eagles to make sure that, you know, this is not too intrusive. How do you go about having an Eagle Cam that's friendly to the eagles as well as giving us this incredible intimate look into their lives?
Well, that was, of course, a question and a concern to everybody initially, and particularly to me, because I've spent a lifetime trying to protect eagles. But when I saw this camera that this chap had, and the camera was running as the bird returned from its migration on its first year, when it hadn't yet seen the cameras, and it landed on the nest, and it looked and it focused its head over on the other side of the nest, obviously looking into the camera. And it turned its head this way and that way. I mean, absolutely giving the camera an eagle eye death wish. And it walked over and it looked closer. I mean, the beak is now 4 inches away from the camera. And it reaches out and it goes thump, thump. And you can hear on the camera go click, click as the beak hits the thing. The eagle turns its head and walks away. And in the next 6-7 years, it never once bothers looking at the darn camera again. So, I mean, that in itself was a kind of proof that that bird was totally satisfied with what it saw. Now, we see this every year with every eagle that comes to the nest. You will see it initially look up at the cameras. But, you know, we are dealing with a creature that is adapted to living in and among people and houses. And so many of the eagle nests are directly above a garage or a house. And very often, even on migrations, the eagles are sitting in fishing harbors and they're sitting on the boat mast. And beside them on the boat mast is a thumping, pulsing light. Just one of the nests just down the road from me here is a cell tower. And because it's in the path of an aircraft, it's got a huge, a 3 foot high light pulsing on it to keep aircraft away. That eagle at night goes and leans up against that pulsing light. And it's getting some warmth or something from that light. Maybe it's the beat of its music. I don't know. But I mean, the bottom line is you look at these things and you can't conclude that the bird is disturbed by them. I mean, it's obviously not disturbed by them. It doesn't give a darn about them. And every time we get something about people and interaction, they set our mind at ease. And so that answers your question. It's the eagle itself that simply tells us by its actions that it doesn't give a darn about our snooping into its lifestyle.
Oh, that's very cool. Oh, and Terry, what are some of the things that you do to take precautions for the safety of the eagles that are under your watch?
Well, we have to follow the U.S. Fish and Wildlife guidelines. So we're overseen by a local biologist here in the Redding area. And we have to make sure that any work that we do above the nest is done when the eagles are not in the area. That's really important. And I learned that from David as well. You don't want those eagles to see a man standing up in its nest or that close to its nest, or there's a good possibility they're going to go off somewhere else and nest. So we're really careful about that. And our eagles are here till about mid-July and they come back in October. So they're here for about 9.5 months. So we don't have a long window to get our work done. But any work that we do out on the island near the eagle's nest, we make sure to do that while they're out of the area.
And can you comment on, there are so many eagle cameras now on the web that you can watch all over the place. Are you fairly well connected with each other, the eagle cam community?
Well, we had the world's first cameras on any kind of wildlife, and certainly the first in an eagle's nest, and it became very popular. By the time we'd had 2 years running, there was all of a sudden, in the second end of the second year, there were about a dozen cameras running because it was obviously such a popular way of both science but public outreach. I mean, it works both ways. Scientists get to understand so much more by watching the cameras, but the public just gets this unbelievable opportunity to see things that they'd never even imagined. I mean, watching the eagles go into labor, mate on the nest, eat, and see the chicks when the eggs pip, and the little, what is called the egg tooth on the top part of the beak, it scratches a hole in the egg from the inside. And the beak all of a sudden pokes through and it breathes its first bit of air. Well, these are moments that not many people have seen in any living bird, let alone in something as big and dramatic as bald eagle. So it just caught on. From our eagle exploits with the cameras, it's gone to every kind of bird, from hummingbirds to penguins to ostrich to cranes across Europe and nesting in people's chimneys and so on. It's just been an exciting thing to have launched to the world. I mean, it was kind of an honor that we were able to be the ones that did that.
Yeah, I've got friends that they have bird feeders that have built-in cameras that they get because they just enjoy watching the birds, you know, feeding. It's definitely caught on and it is a phenomenon. What is it, Terry, do you think about eagles that make them just such compelling actors to watch, though?
Well, they are a beautiful, majestic bird, just gorgeous birds, in my opinion. I'm quite biased, but I just think they're a beautiful bird, and they represent, you know, just such strength. And so people are drawn to them, I think, naturally. But I think, you know, this, like David was saying, something about watching that eagle cam just has a unique way of bringing people together. You know, we're all just, you know, falling in love with these birds together. We have a shared love, admiration that we can share. We go through, you know, difficult times. I mean, these are wild birds. I mean, there's going to be death and, you know, some hard things to deal with. But we do have an eagle community that we've developed. And so we share those difficult moments together. And I think it's really a beautiful thing. And we hear from all the people on our Facebook page, reach out to us and just tell us, you know, how much it means to them in their own lives to be able to watch something like this and how it affects them. And it's really wonderful and beautiful to to hear about.
Well, Terry Lewillier, from the Friends of the Reading Eagles and the Reading Eagle Cam up there, and David Hancock, thanks so much for sharing your passion for eagles and British Columbia and Northern California, and for, you know, letting us all share in the experience of watching these magnificent birds in their nests.
Well, thanks for your program, Dave. Appreciate it very much.
Yes, and thank you, Dave, for we feel the more people who watch and fall in love with these eagles, we're going to have more people who are out there helping protect them and all wildlife. So we really appreciate you guys.
Thanks again to our guests, Director of the California Raptor Center at UC Davis, Michelle Hawkins. You can learn more about their work at crc.vetmed.ucdavis.edu. And Terry Lewillier from the Friends of the Reading Eagles. Check out their Eagle Cam to watch Liberty and Guardian and their eaglets on YouTube. And David Hancock from the Hancock Wildlife Foundation in British Columbia. You can check out their work and their Eagle Cams at hancockwildlife.org. And this just in, the eaglets that Liberty and Guardian have reared in the Redding, California nest have been named after a poll by folks who watch the Eagle Cam there. They are Sol and Luna, Sun and Moon, which sounds just perfect to me. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of Cap Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX. If you want to revisit, share, or check out past episodes, you can do just that on our website, mynspr.org. And while you're at it, subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode on our website, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music, Big Wave Dave, is by Matt Schiltz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fiddler. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.